Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn, and it's Free for All Friday, which means we get to have fun and explore a wide variety of topics not usually covered in our podcasts on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I think it's a fun way to end the week, and I'm always glad when you're able to join me for it. So today's Free for All Friday, I'm going to talk about tropes, T-R-O-P-E-S. What is a trope? Now, you've definitely seen a trope, even if you don't know the name connected to it. So that's what we're going to discuss today. There's a whole website dedicated to them called TV Tropes, tvtropes.com, and they're popular storytelling devices and patterns you recognize in fiction and artwork. We're going to get into more of what tropes are here in a second, but if you go to tvtropes.com, you can get lost in it. It's a huge encyclopedia showing where these kinds of tropes tend to show up. Sometimes they are particular narrative devices, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Other times, they're phrases that people say. And sometimes these phrases can go from being a trope to being a cliche if they're used too much. For example, one trope that I like, even though it's kind of cliche, is when the hero stands off against the villain and the hero says, "I'm here to stop you." The villain says, "You and what army?" And then he says, "This one." Now, sometimes it's reversed. Sometimes the hero thinks he has the villain on the ropes and he's like, "I'm going to stop you." And he always says, "You and what army?" And the villain says, "This one." And then sometimes the trope is subverted. He says, "You and what army?" "This one." And we think there's an army behind the hero, but he's been abandoned. And he's like, "Oh, what's going on?" Like, if you go on YouTube and search "You and what army," there's whole clips assembling where this particular trope comes from. And people can debate whether it's a cliche or not. But let me read from Adam Hine. He has an article about this, about the difference between tropes and cliches. So a trope, in a story sense, is any plot, character, setting, device, or pattern that we recognize as such. It's kind of everything, from the unassuming farm boy to the rebellion against an oppressive government to the wise mentor to the chase scene in which the car smashes through a pane of glass being carried across the street. Tropes are what makes stories run. A story is not good or bad based on whether or not it has tropes. All stories have tropes. A story is good or bad based on how those tropes are used. What we like about tropes is familiarity. Yay, ninjas! Or excitement. Ooh, the hero's going to get all awesome on the bad guys. And especially when our favorite tropes are twisted in interesting ways, i.e., I did not see that coming. What we don't like is when tropes are predictable to the point of boredom. That's when a trope becomes a cliche. So, when you're watching a piece of work, especially a film or a television show, you can know, you'll see things and you'll recognize patterns in storytelling, whether it's a particular kind of character, like the father who knows best, the rambunctious, rebellious kid always getting into trouble, or things that they do, like keeping a secret and it ends up backfiring on you. Those are tropes, and fiction and artwork and literature are full of them. The question is, when you watch a piece of art, does it use a trope well? Tropes are like colors. So if you see a painting is not good or bad based on whether it has colors or not, because there are bad paintings with colors and there are good paintings with colors. The question is, how are the colors used together to create something that's new, unexpected, or reaches us in unique and interesting ways? And that's the same with tropes. So what I want to talk about today are tropes you may not have heard of. You may not have heard of the terms describing these. Well, one of them you probably have, but for most, you may not have heard the terms. But as you watch different kinds of fiction, especially television and movies, you will see these tropes come up. You'll say, "Oh, I know that one." And you'll start seeing them more and more once you know what they are. So let's get into it. Our first trope, lampshade hanging. What in the world is lampshade hanging? Lampshade hanging, or this is from tvtropes.com, or more informally, lampshading, is the writer's trick of dealing with any element of the story that threatens the audience's willing suspension of disbelief, whether a very implausible plot development or a particularly blatant use of a trope, by calling attention to it and simply moving on. The reason for this counterintuitive strategy is twofold. First, it assures the audience that the author is aware of the implausible plot development that just happened, and that they aren't trying to slip something past the audience. Second, it assures the audience that the world of the story is like real life. What's implausible for you or me is just as implausible for these characters and just as likely to provoke an incredulous response. So lampshade hanging is when something comes up in a story. Here's just a generic example. Actually, we did this once in a parody of a film we were making for our youth group. And I had one of the characters say the line, "Oh man, this is just like in one of those bad B movies." And then he looks at the camera and then looks back at the other characters. That's a combination of another trope, actually, called breaking the fourth wall. So imagine you're on a stage. There are three walls, stage right, stage left, and the back of the stage, upstage. And then there's an imaginary fourth wall, which is what divides the people on the stage from people in the audience. Breaking the fourth wall is when a character looks directly at, let's say in film or television, at the camera and says, you know, speaks to the audience directly when normally they wouldn't do that. Most famous examples of that would be Ferris Bueller's Day Off, when Matthew Broderick's character Ferris Bueller looks at the camera and talks to us directly. So actually in that element, I hung the lampshade. I think there's a cartoon that relates to this. It's something like the villain is about to like kill the bad guys and a henchman walks in. "Sir, we have this lampshade you'll need later." "Oh, just hang it over there." It's kind of a meta comic, but the idea is you bring attention to something improbable. That way you tell the audience, "Yes, I know you find this hard to believe. I do too. Let's just go along with it for the sake of the story so we can all have fun." So it's a part of the willing suspension of disbelief. So in my parody video we did, the line, "This is just like in a bad B movie," I'm telling the audience, "Yes, I know what this is, but just go along with it and still stay tuned that the world I'm showing you is somewhat similar to the world you and I occupy," to allow the events of the narrative to move forward. Here's another example of that from SpongeBob SquarePants. So in the cartoon SpongeBob SquarePants, you've got SpongeBob, who's a sponge, and Patrick, the starfish, and you know, all these other characters live at the Bikini Bottom, at the bottom of the ocean, and they get in all these wacky hijinks. But of course, things will happen that can't happen at the bottom of the ocean, like they'll be sitting around a campfire. And every now and then they will draw attention to this fact to quickly dismiss it so that the narrative can just move forward and people can have fun. So here's an example of that where the captain sends an invitation to SpongeBob to read.
"Say, you didn't bring SpongeBob with you, did you? Gee, I sure hope he got his invitation.
I'd sure like to go to this party, but I can't read the invitation."
"Me neither."
"Whoever sent this obviously has no idea about the physical limitations of life underwater. Well, might as well throw these in the fire."
So there's the example right there where they make fun of the fact of writing down things underwater, which you couldn't read it. The ink would run everywhere. Let's just not worry about that. Throw that into the fire. And so it's a delightfully meta-analysis, a way of standing outside of the work to comment on it and be able to share with other people. So that is lampshade hanging. The next one is flanderization. Flanderization. What is that? Flanderization is the act of taking a single, often minor action or trait of a character within a work and exaggerating it more and more over time until it completely consumes the character. Most always, the trait action becomes completely outlandish and it becomes their defining characteristic. Sitcoms and sitcom characters are particularly susceptible to this, as are peripheral characters in shows with long runs. Before I get into why it's called flanderization, an example of this, like if you watch The Office, the NBC sitcom The Office, watch season one. It's really funny. You see characters dramatically change. Like if you see characters like Kevin or Kelly, they're just kind of normal office workers. And then as seasons two and three go on, their traits start to develop. Like Kelly gets a little more vapid. Kevin gets a little bit more dim-witted. But by the end of the series, Kelly is just this complete, almost Valley Girl-esque character who's completely self-absorbed, and Kevin is, you don't know how he's functioning in the world with his IQ, that at one point he almost dies being left in a hot car because he doesn't get out of it when he's trying to signal that it's unsafe to be in a car with the windows closed and locked, that Kevin's character becomes a complete dimwit or someone who shouldn't function in the regular world by the end of the series. That's flanderization. You have a character, usually a peripheral character in a series, that their one trait, peripheral trait that makes them different from other people becomes their overarching defining trait, and they become more of a caricature than a character. So the name of the trope, then, continuing on the description, it says, it's named for one of the examples in The Simpsons, Ned Flanders, who was originally just a considerate neighbor and attentive father, with his devout nature simply being that he willingly attended and paid attention in church, all to make him a contrast to Homer, before becoming obsessively religious. Note that the key to this trope is in how the process is a gradual thing. The character starts relatively normally with a few quirks. The quirks become more prominent, then the quirks gradually become the character. So sometimes you'll see dramatic changes for no reason, but here is when you take a minor element of the character, and then that becomes the character's major element. So with Ned Flanders, if you watch the early episodes of the seasons, Ned Flanders, his character was not this ridiculously religious person. It was just Homer was the incompetent father, and Ned Flanders was the competent father. And so, you know, Homer would be mean or uncaring or a doofus and not, you know, he's not religious also. And Flanders would be the opposite of these things. Flanders was not an inverted Homer, but he served as just a contrast to what Homer would do. Flanders is kind of the opposite of that. And one of those things was Flanders' religious nature. Hi-ly ho, neighborinos. You know, he was more just, you know, just this nice, overly nice and semi-intrusive person. But someone who was at least somewhat competent. Then as the series went on, Ned Flanders just became this hopelessly obsessive religious person who almost had like obsessive compulsive disorder and scruples because he couldn't function in the world without being, you know, seeing religious rules and paradigms in everything, being overly restrictive, puritanical. But his character wasn't like that at the beginning, and it became that later on. Ironically enough, in The Simpsons, one thing that was Flanderized was Homer Simpson himself. Now, I personally do not like The Simpsons after season 9. I'm not a big fan. A lot of the good writers left around that time, and the series has just gone downhill ever since. I haven't watched a new Simpsons episode in years. I really only trust seasons 2 through 9. Even season 1 is fine, but they're still trying to get their sea legs, so to speak. But seasons 2 through 9 are just awesome. You have writers like Conan O'Brien. You just have people in there who really know what they're doing, and the characters are really fleshed out. And it's still a believable universe. And Homer Simpson is like a believable regular person, albeit he gets into hijinks. But when he gets into hijinks, there are consequences. Like when he loses his job, there's serious issues he has to grapple with when he has to go get another job. And there's an opening scene, actually, where Homer feels like such a failure of a father. He plans to go jump off a bridge and kill himself. It's actually pretty dark, but they tackle tough things. And the characters had, you know, as a character, Homer Simpson, yeah, he wasn't necessarily the brightest person, but he was still competent. He was someone, I guess I should characterize as Flanders and Homer are both competent in different ways. Flanders knows how to play by all the rules, and Homer just kind of does things his own way, for better or worse. But when you compare that, as the series went on, Homer became someone just radically different. So in the later seasons of The Simpsons, Homer would become like an illiterate person who had like no intelligence. Like he sees a gym and he would say, "Gym? What's that?" Like he couldn't even read. And then he's baffled by seeing a gym or things like that. Whereas that's not how his character was early on in the series. And in fact, there is an episode of The Simpsons that kind of makes a joke of this in a meta way called Homer to the Max, where Homer is delighted that there's an action show on TV and the main character is named Homer Simpson. And he's like this tough cop guy. And he's like, and Homer thinks this is great until that character changes and becomes this ridiculous dolt that nobody takes seriously, which leads Homer to change his name later in the episode to the only name the judge will allow him to change it to, which was the name he saw on a hairdryer that he thought was really cool, Max Power. Get it? But here's a clip of The Simpsons that makes my point when he's in a bar and sees what has happened to the fictional Homer Simpson and how that character was Flanderized, which is a meta comment on kind of what happened to Homer Simpson himself.
Hey, what's going on? That guy's not Homer Simpson. He's fat and stupid.
Hey, looks like they changed the character into a bumbling sidekick.
No, he can't be. I know, maybe he's just acting stupid to infiltrate a gang of international idiots. Yeah, that's gotta be it.
You destroyed that drug shipment?
Yes, indeedy.
That was my insulin!
Uh-oh, SpaghettiOs!
Simpson!
Hi, Homer.
That character is you all over.
Come on, Homer, act all stupid, like you do on TV.
Yeah, come on, dum-dum, do something unintelligent there.
Shut up! I'm not your clown! Don't diminish me!
Gentlemen, I bid you farewell!
And then his scarf gets caught in a ceiling fan and he gets looped around. So, Flanderization, keep an eye out in your favorite shows. Was there a character that they were well-defined at the beginning, and then one trait kind of took over, and that's who you know them by? Well, they were Flanderized. All right, next one is the bottle episode. The bottle episode. What is that? A bottle episode. So this one is not about characters as much as it's about story structure. A bottle episode is designed to take up as little money as possible. You see this in television a lot. The easiest way to go about this is to use only the regular cast, or even just part of the regular cast, and set it in a single location, especially if you have a main standing set. This keeps production costs down because no one needs to scout locations, build new sets, or create fancy CGI graphics outside the spaceship. So it goes. Some plots lend themselves to the nature of a bottle episode. So some of these include things like locked in a room, characters are stuck in a physical place and can't get out, episode on a plane, the trope of the whole thing takes place on an airplane, Groundhog Day loops. So if you have an episode where someone is repeating a time loop, you can reuse, you can do a bottle episode with a time loop by just keeping them in the same, the reason you keep them in the same location is because time is looping and you're trying to figure things out. Bottle episode was used, I think its first usage was with Star Trek, the original Star Trek series. And when they were kind of out of money, they would kind of keep people on the ship and not send them to an alien planet. And those were called bottle episodes. They'd have to come up with reasons to keep people on the ship in specific sets they already had built and to keep things entertaining. Here's a video that talks about how there was an episode of Breaking Bad where Walter White, I think he spends like the whole episode chasing a fly. And if you look at IMDb.com, it's like the worst rated episode in the series, one of the worst rated. And people ask, why does every series have one of these bottle episodes that usually aren't good? Why would showrunners do that? This YouTube video on Cheddar Explains says why Breaking Bad did that particular bottle episode.
But this was the case for Breaking Bad's episode Fly.
As the show's creator, Vince Gilligan, told Vulture in an interview, "We were hopelessly over budget, and we needed to come up with what is called a bottle episode, set in one location. Their budgetary restrictions didn't allow them the $25,000 to $35,000 needed to move the production trucks to a new location. With an average episode of Breaking Bad costing $9.5 million to create, it's understandable that at some point they needed to cut back."
Not only do they save money, but showrunners and creators stand by them as creative choices.
Vince Gilligan told the AV Club in an interview, "Even if financial realities didn't enter into it, I feel as a showrunner that there should be a certain shape and pace to each season. And the really high highs that you try to get at the end of a season, the big dramatic moments of action and violence, the big operatic moments you're striving for, I don't think would land as hard if you didn't have the moments of quiet that came before them."
So that's interesting that some people defend bottle episodes not just as elements where we're not just trying to save money, because that might be crude. Like, oh, if you're just trying to save money, you're trying to do art. I think some people will say we want to do a bottle episode because there's a challenge. How do we make a really good episode that people will watch while restricting ourselves and not allowing ourselves different sets or guest stars or a large ensemble cast? It becomes a challenge for directors to say, you know, showrunners, content creators, all right, I've placed these restrictions on myself. How am I going to make a good show with the restrictions I have? So it becomes a bit of a challenge in that way. One of the most famous examples of meeting the challenge, I would say, was the television show Community, which is hilarious, by the way. You've got to go and check it out online. They do a lot of different episodes where they focus on particular genres and make fun of them. It's about a bunch of people who go to who attend a community college. It's starring people like Joel McHale, Chevy Chase. They've got a lot of great talent on there. And there was an episode they did. It was called the Community Does a Bottle Episode, I think is what it was called. Or at least it was recognized to be the bottle episode, because in the first like opening of the show, this is the exchange the characters have. And Abed, one of the characters, he forthrightly points out, "Uh-oh, we're doing a bottle episode here."
"Okay. Are we going to the puppy parade or not? Because it's starting to feel like a bottle episode."
"Again with the TV crap. Hey, Meatball, did you take Annie's pen to make life more like Benny Hill or whatever you do?"
"Abed?
I wouldn't do that. I hate bottle episodes. Their wall-to-wall facial expression and emotional nuance. I might as well sit in the corner with a bucket on my head.
What? Whoever the pen thief is just stood there and watched me get Guantanamo'd.
So they're all trying to find out who stole this pen. And Abed says, I hate bottle episodes. They're wall-to-wall facial expressions. I might as well. He has Asperger's. And so people on the autism spectrum have his character has that. And so they have a hard time discerning like facial expressions. So that's the joke he made. It's like, look, bottle episodes are low on action, high on character conflict and interaction between characters. No, let's get something happening already. So they go on and then he says, yep, looks like we're going full bottle episode here. So that's an example of television show Community taking the bottle episode idea, the trope, and trying to subvert it to like go full forward bottle episode to do the best they can with making fun of the concept. Next, you've heard of this trope. You know this one, cliffhangers. You have, usually occurs in serials. No, not cereals you eat. In fact, I remember Al Gore was being interviewed by Oprah, and Oprah asks him, what's your favorite cereal? He says, Oprah. And what he meant was not, she meant the cereal you eat, and he thought S-E-R-I-A-L, you know, a cereal, a television show that runs in a series. So, as I remember that. A cereal, you know, something like a television series that goes on and on. A lot of times, especially with binge watching now at Netflix, this is huge. It feels like every episode ends with a cliffhanger because all the content is there and they want you to binge watch. And so you have to just keep going, basically. So that's what the cliffhanger is. Usually a to-be-continued caption is used. The longer the viewer is made to wait, the larger the seeming peril can be. In fact, this can be a downer ending to the part that just finished. And so when it comes to cliffhangers, what's hard is some cliffhangers you'll end, especially like when a season ends on a cliffhanger, if the show is not picked up for renewal, that's very unsatisfying to the viewers because it didn't resolve you know, what was the issue? Oh, now we'll never know. So Mork and Mindy, the old television show, Nano Nano, with Robin Williams, Mork and Mindy ended on a cliffhanger where they go back in time. We don't know what happens. My Name is Earl ended on a cliffhanger. You never find out who Earl's father is. One show I liked back in the day was Spider-Man, the animated series. That was a great television show, and I cannot wait to introduce it to my kids. But it ends with Peter Parker, Spider-Man. He goes into the Spider-Verse, and he's trying to find Mary Jane, who's disappeared in an alternate dimension. He thought he had found her before, but she turned out to be a clone. And so he goes to find her, and finally he meets Madame Web, this interdimensional being. And he meets Stan Lee first, then Madame Web, and he's going to go. And she's like, it's time for you to meet the real Mary Jane, to really find happiness. And he's like, amen, sister. And the show ends and we never see him reunite with Mary Jane. And he was supposed to have a wedding with the animated cameo officiated by Stan Lee. And it never happened. And my inner 9-year-old is still mad about it. And I want that to be resolved. I want it resolved. Another one my inner 9-year-old is mad about is ALF. You remember ALF? Based on the sitcom that aired from 1986 to 1990, ALF stands for Alien Life Form. And it had, you know, the original, they had this like puppet with like a weird nose voiced by Paul Fusco. And he always kind of talk like this, you know, is that ALF's voice? I don't know. We'll find out. I'm about to play the clip here. And in the last episode, Consider Me Gone, this is like the series finale, it ends with ALF thinking ALF is going to go home to his home planet, and he ends up being captured by the government instead. So here's the clip.
ALF, someone's coming. Get back here. What?
And then the government agents show up.
Dad, do something!
Stay right where you are.
Oh. Hey, guys. You want to grab a brewski? What about those Lakers, huh? Just my luck. I'm a sports fan among you.
And then it just says to be continued. And as you can tell from that brief 2 minutes of the very end of ALF, that was basically the kind of humor you had on ALF. is not a great show. Go back and watch the old shows. I remember liking them as a kid, but of course I was a child, and children have terrible taste. So I remember being a child and loving the show Full House, because it's like watching what were like grown-ups to me engaging in hijinks, and I thought it was hilarious. Then you go back and try to watch it, and you're like, ooh, this is actually not very good at all. Works for undiscerning child minds, I suppose. But Alf had that similar humor and all that. So it ends. It was picked up in the 1986 made-for-TV film Project Alf tries to resolve it, but that was just terrible. That shall never go mentioned ever again. Oh, and finally, the other most famous example of a cliffhanger, it's got to be the original 1960s Batman television series. A lot of them ended on cliffhangers where Batman and Robin were in some kind of trap and you didn't know how they were going to get out of it. So I've got to play this one for you. This is where Batman and Robin, typical 1960s campy Batman, played by Burt Ward as Robin and Adam West as Batman. One of my top three Batmen of all time is going to go with Adam West, who also cameoed on Batman the Animated Series as the Gray Ghost. Another good episode there. So Mr. Freeze, and so campy, I love it. Mr. Freeze put Batman and Robin in these giant snow cones, and he's going to turn them into snow cones. And, well, here's how it all goes.
So you wanted to outsmart me, hey? But you can't outsmart the machinery in this factory. And soon you'll be the first two human frosty freezes in history. Ha ha ha! Wild!
Can this, this be happening? Batman being made into a pineapple frosty freezy, and Robin into a lime one? Has the diabolical Mr. Freeze outwitted the dynamic duo after all with some fancy ice work? Hope for a miracle and stay frozen in your seats. Until tomorrow, same time, same channel.
Batman! And now, when I was a kid, the 1966 Batman film, that was one of my favorites as a kid, to watch. I tried showing it to Laura once and she was like, what is this? And I'm like, yeah, might have been more endearing to me when I was a child. Once again, we should call those child goggles. But it still has, it's a delightful, quirky, campy romp that I also recommend. But the Batman television show from the 1960s, I think that's the most famous example of television shows using cliffhangers. And now the last one, the Deus Ex Machina. Deus Ex Machina literally means God from the machine. It's basically when something coincidental happens, something beyond the character's control, something that seems completely unlikely swoops in to save them from a problem. So according to TV Tropes, this occurs when some new event, character, ability, or object solves a seemingly unsolvable problem in a sudden, unexpected way. It's often used as a solution to what is called writing yourself into a corner, where the problem is so extreme that nothing in the established setting suggests that there is a logical way for the characters to escape. If a bomb is about to go off, someone finds a convenient bomb-proof bunker in easy reach. If a protagonist falls off a cliff, a flying robot will suddenly appear to catch them. Emma Coates, a quotation for this, says, "Coincidences to get characters into trouble are great. Coincidences to get them out of trouble are cheating." And Deus Ex Machina, God from the Machine, refers to in ancient Greece, sometimes to resolve dramatic productions, the gods would be lowered by pulleys, and they would just appear and solve the problems for the characters. So they're not the characters organically solving the problem themselves. It's when an outside force or something else unexpectedly and not connected to the previous events in the story solves it for them. And so that can be pretty... it's something that isn't very satisfying. It's not the same as a twist. A twist is okay if they do something, you're like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But then when you put the pieces together, you're like, oh, I should have seen that coming if I was paying attention. Deus Ex Machina, it just doesn't play by the rules. If it's a solution that doesn't play by the rules in the universe of what's being put forward, then that's what it qualifies as being that particular kind of trope. Now, this occurs, sometimes it can be a big Deus Ex Machina. It's something that solves the whole problem of everything. But there's a whole subgenre of tropes related to this that are expedient storytelling devices that help move the story along, even though they're not really logical. And you don't notice these. When you start to look for them, then you really start to see them. So one of these would be the coincidental broadcast. This is what TV Trope says. A coincidental broadcast is any television or radio accidentally turned on during a tension-filled moment will automatically display a news story relevant to or actually about the current source of dramatic tension. You know, so they'll tune on, often the news reporter will come off slightly medium aware, saying something like, "We repeat," or "For those of you just tuning in," they'll happen to turn the TV on right when they say, "For those of you just tuning in," you know, the characters will see an explosion outside and they're like, "What happened?" And they turn on the TV and it's not like, you know, they're on the wrong channel. And it's like the ShamWow is going to get everything clean for you. You know, it's always a news broadcast and it's right in the middle of exactly what they need to hear. If you're just tuning in, so you'll have these kinds of coincidences sometimes in stories. So they're a variant of Deus Ex Machina. And a lot of times you can tell lazy writing that when you have to get characters together, when a writer has to rely on coincidence that much in order to move the story along. What's weird is it's obvious when you try thinking about it, but if you're really suspending disbelief, you don't notice it. I'll share with you a clip from Pitch Meeting. Pitch Meeting is a wonderful series of comedy videos on YouTube. It's Screen Rant, and it stars the same guy. I think his name's Ryan George. And he plays two characters, a Hollywood producer and a writer. And the writer says, "I've got this great story idea for you." He's like, "Let me hear it." And they go back and forth. And the writer says, "Here's what we're going to do with the film." And the producer's like, "That doesn't make quite a lot of sense." And the writer says, "Yeah, but it's going to make a lot of money." And the producer says, "Oh, okay, that sounds good." And so the producer keeps pointing out how like stuff in the story doesn't make a ton of sense. And in the recent Star Trek reboot that J.J. Abrams did, that was the one where you have a Romulan Nero who goes back in time, and the original Spock goes back in time, and he meets young Spock, and he meets a young James T. Kirk. We're going to be on the Enterprise together. It was Abrams' reboot of the Star Trek series, and it's a great film. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it for the sense that it was a nice action film, even if it wasn't really truly Star Trek. It was still just a nice Abrams action movie. But at one point, Kirk sneaks onto the Enterprise, and they need to find a way to get James Kirk, the young James Kirk, to meet old Spock who came from the future. You haven't learned this yet as a viewer. But then a series of coincidences happen to bring that about. And when you think about it more, it's weird. It's not as noticeable as you're watching the movie because it's exciting. But when you do a postmortem on it, it's just kind of funny. So here's the Pitch Meeting talking about that element from the recent Star Trek film.
Spock and Kirk get into this big argument, so Spock has to deal with them.
So he, like, puts him in a cell for insubordination?
No, he puts him in a space pod and shoots him off onto a dangerous ice planet.
Oh my god, why would he do that?
Because I need him to do that for the movie.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So Kirk immediately gets attacked by this big monster thing, and so he runs into a cave, and that's where he meets an old Spock that traveled back in time.
What?
Pretty cool, right?
On the surface of an entire planet, Kirk just happens to walk into the cave where a time-traveling Spock is hanging out?
That's what we're going with.
That works for me.
And so time travel Spock drops a bunch of exposition on him. He's like, "Yeah, I tried to save Nero's planet in the future with some red matter, but then it didn't work and he got mad and he got sent back in time and so did I, but there was a difference of like 25 years for some reason, and so he's all mad and he wants to blow up a bunch of planets."
So Nero got sent back in time on what just happened to be Kirk's birthday?
That's right.
And he got sent back to before his planet was ever destroyed?
That's right.
And then he just hangs out for like 25 years?
Yeah,
And if at any moment in those 25 years he happened to find out what the date was, there would be no conflict in the movie whatsoever?
Yeah, pretty much. If Nero found out what year it was, he can go stop the thing that he's mad about happening, because it hasn't happened yet.
Well, maybe on the DVD we can have an alternate ending where Nero just looks at a calendar and solves everything.
Maybe.
So what else?
I would recommend that if you want a good laugh. These are really great pitch meetings. I've got like over 100 of them for popular films. That's at Screen Rant. Just search for Pitch Meeting. Something when I need to take a break from working and my brain is drained, that's one comedy series that I've thoroughly enjoyed. Hey, I hope you guys enjoyed spending time with me here on Free For All Friday. Keep an eye out for TV Tropes. We covered the Deus Ex Machina, Cliffhangers, the Bottle Episode, Flanderization, and Lampshade Hanging. There are a ton more. If you want to lose a lot of your weekend, fair warning, you will lose a lot of your weekend if you could jump down this rabbit hole. Search for TV Tropes. Go to TVTropes.com. And you will find so many, so many more. So I really hope you enjoyed this. Thank you guys so much. Be sure to leave a review at iTunes or Google Play. That's always helpful for us. And I hope that you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.